Okay, my name is Matt Williams. Good to be together this week as we're studying. We got a lot to do. Let me just say something that I think encapsulates this idea when we're talking about sex in the context of marriage and the role that it plays, the value that it has, and how challenging and complicated it can be. I live on a couple acres, and there's always, I didn't know this about trees till I moved there, even though I grew up kind of on a farm, trees are always dying. They're either growing, you know, when they're young, after that, they are just dying. And so after every storm, and we've had a number of them in the last number of months, we will have limbs, trees that fall, just it is constant work keeping this place clean. And so the best way to do that, the most efficient way, is with fire. And one of the things that I have noticed, and I love to burn a fire, I love to see the efficiency, the consuming heat, just destroy stuff that was creating all these problems. I love all that idea. But the thing about a fire is that when it is wet or windy, it is amazing to me within just a couple hours, something that is so fragile, that is so hard to get started, so delicate, has to be cared for, pampered, so delicate, within just a couple hours can become such a raging heat that it does not matter what you throw on it. And the other day, we got this fire really, really hot, and I'm laying green, they have green leaves on them, just the pine needles, and it's just incinerating as soon as it hits them, just evaporating them. It's so hot, and so this tree just had fallen, it's green, it's got water in it, and it is just consuming these green limbs. And I thought, it's just interesting that at this moment, it's so fragile and you're having a hard time getting it started. But when it's cultivated in full strength, it can consume anything, becomes very powerful. So the weakness and the power in this one thing. Now, this is very typical of many things in life, but particularly of this issue of sexuality in the context of our closest relationship of marriage. So there's a fragility to it, and there's a power to it. And knowing how to manage that and think through that at different seasons is pretty important. So let's just, on the basis of where we're going, let's just recap our basic definition. Most of our men have been through this. If you haven't, there'll be an opportunity, whatever campus you're on, to go through the core men's roundtable. Four basic ideas: to reject passivity, to accept responsibility, to lead courageously, to expect God's reward. This is our basic definition that we work from. This is the basic grid that helps us think through how we move into any issue. It just so happens at this point, the issue at hand is the idea of our sexual purity, and particularly, even more so, sexuality in the context of marriage. We have been called to reject passivity, accept responsibility, lead courageously, even on this issue, or especially on this issue. I've been married 25 years in the next month or so. I have 5 children from 20 years old down to 9. I am married to a strong Scots-Irish woman. Last name, Stevens and Nelson. That's what makes up her family. And I've told them, I was like, the two names that should not come together, two Scots-Irish names, Stevens and Nelson. You're a strong-willed group of people, all right? So I'm just saying, it has been an incredible experiment that God calls marriage for us, and we have learned a lot. And I am still amazed at how strong the base can be after 25 years of marriage, but also how quickly that can be eroded. Very quickly. All right, so let's look at Song of Solomon chapter 7. And then we'll read through a few verses, and then we're going to race through some big ideas to consider to think about. Song of Solomon, this book on this relationship with Solomon and this woman. Verse 1, he says, "How beautiful are your sandaled feet, O queenly maiden. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a skilled craftsman. He has started low at her feet, and he is working his way up her body, extolling what he views as her beauty. Your navel is perfectly formed like a goblet filled with mixed wine. Between your thighs lies a mound of wheat bordered with lilies." You're like, no, wait a minute. It's early. I'm trying to grasp. That's exactly what he's talking about. Verse 3, "Your breasts are like two fawns, twin fawns of a gazelle." The scholars, theologians from the Middle Ages could not bring themselves to believe that God would speak this clearly about sensuality and sexuality, so they were allegory in their thinking. So what they did was they said, obviously, the twin fawns of the gazelle are the Word of God and the Spirit of God. This is obviously not talking about actual breasts. This is Word of God and Spirit of God. I mean, that is dumb. I'm no scholar, but that's dumb. Verse 4, your neck is as beautiful as an ivory tower. I've never seen an ivory tower. I'm going to take his word for it. Your eyes are like the sparkling pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bat Rabin. We don't know the context of any of these things, but we know that he's in it with her. Your nose is as fine as the Tower of Lebanon overlooking Damascus. You're like, I'll take that. I think he means it as a compliment. Who knows? Your head is as majestic as Mount Carmel. The sheen of your hair radiates royalty. The king is held captive by its tresses. Oh, how beautiful you are, how pleasing, my love, how full of delights. And when you read that, you're thinking, well, obviously, she's the queen. She's the prettiest woman in the world. There's no evidence, no objective way to know how she looks. What do we know from this passage? We know that he thinks she's beautiful. There's, from culture to culture, if you go spend 10 years in any culture, your taste and what you think is attractive and beautiful will change because that culture will shape you. There is no objective standard of what beauty is. It's all subjective. What we learn from this is not how beautiful she is. Maybe she is, maybe she's not. There's no such thing as the most beautiful woman in the world. What we learn from this is that he is completely captivated by her. Is that he is intimately connected, and so he sees her as very, very beautiful. And so what you find is, and this is important for marriage and for singles, is that intimacy and objectivity function at opposite ends. They work in an inverse relationship. So let me show you. And a lot of you have seen this before. We've talked about this before. Early on, when you meet someone, you do not know them. Objectivity is high. When objectivity is high, you've just met them, intimacy very low. See? But after you've known someone, you've gotten physically, emotionally, intimately connected. Intimacy becomes high, but notice what happens to objectivity. It begins to drop. That's what's happened to this man, which is a good thing. This is a great thing for marriage, is that we get intimately connected. It's how God's created us. And as we get intimately connected in the way that God's created, objectivity begins to drop. So what we tell our single folks is this is important for marriage, that you want to be intimately connected. You want objectivity to be low in a marriage. But when you are meeting someone as a single, when you start to date, you want objectivity to stay high as long as it can, which is why you are trying to hold off intimacy. Which means that there's this season right here in the middle for our singles where you have a short window of time to be able to make a great decision about the person you're getting connected to, because at some point you get really connected to them, you lose objectivity. You lose objectivity, you wind up marrying what? An idiot. All right? So that's why you want to be really, really careful early on to not get too connected too soon so you can remain objective, make sure that you're getting connected to the right person. So this is what's happened to him. This is very important for singles and for married folks. For married folks, this loss of objectivity is great. The building of intimacy, huge. For singles, good too. It just has to be managed in a different way. Verse 7, you are slender like a palm tree and your breasts are like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree, take hold of its fruit. May your breasts be like grape clusters and the fragrance of your breath like apples. May your kisses be as exciting as the best wine flowing gently from lips and teeth. And so you should grab a commentary on this book and read through Song of Solomon, read through a commentary, get some of the cultural background. But here's what you get, is he is in hot pursuit of this woman. This is not about procreation. He's not thinking about going to raise up the next generation arrows in my quiver. That's not what he's thinking about. He is in pursuit of a woman that he cares very deeply about. And here's what you get. This pursuit is not dirty. It is not weird. It is not a bad thing. It is a good thing. Now, here's what happens for the average married man. I'm saying average. And I'm going to do this two or three times. I'm going to speak in over generalities so that we can move. Okay? If you say, well, I'm different than that, or my wife's different than that, or I know people that are different, I hear you. That's always the case. I'm going to speak in over generalities so we can at least move through something. And your unique case can be different. Mine can be too. It's fine. But for a lot of men and a lot of marriages, when he begins to move towards his wife and pursue her in a passionate way, that is not how she's oriented. She does not feel like that. She does not think like that. She does not want to move like that. That is not how she, and so her first impulse can be, that's different than I am, and she'll use the word, that's weird. I don't like that. That's weird. You're gross. Stop groping me, touching me all the time. And what that shows you is that part of the design of a man is different than the design of a woman. And just like a man has to be taught and trained and discipled in how to care for a woman has to be taught, trained, and discipled how to respond to a man. So a lot of our wives have put up a natural defense or made a natural argument, but the truth is they don't really know because they hadn't been told. So it's part of our role to reject, accept, lead, to be able to help inform them, hey, this is part of how I'm wired, how I'm designed, this is what God's called me to do. It can go too far, we got to bring balance to it. But women can be confused about this point and think that this is some aberration with you or some brokenness within masculinity when really this is how God's created us. Her response, verse 10, I am my lover's and he claims me as his own. Come, my love, let us go to the fields. Spend the night among the wildflowers. Let us get up early, go to the vineyards and see if the grapevines have budded. She's talking about where we're going to go and where her response will be given to him. If the blossoms have opened and the pomegranates have bloomed, there I will give you my love. There the mandrakes will give off their fragrance. Mandrakes, some of these fruits have an erotic look or an erotic fragrance. So she appeals to them for their imagery. The finest fruits are at the door, new delights as well as old. I have saved my love for my lover. He has created a safe environment for her where she feels pursued, she feels valued, and she experiences the freedom to respond. So a woman's ability to respond depends greatly on our ability to pursue and create the environment where it's safe, where it's safe for her to respond. Proverbs chapter 5. I'll just throw in one more. Let your wife be a fountain of blessing for you. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. She is a loving deer and a graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy you always. Notice the word always, and may you always be captivated by her love. Notice the word always. Is that when, a lot of times Christianity gets slammed for having these boundaries we call marriage, and outside those boundaries, they're not supposed to be any physical emotional relationship with other people, but and that is true. But within those boundaries, look how unrestrained it is. It's just interesting that there, within the boundaries, there should be a lack of restraint within the boundaries. Outside the boundaries, there's restraint. But inside the boundaries, a lack of restraint. This is something that does not seem to get communicated well in Christian circles. Notice the lack of restraint. May you always be captivated by her love. Why be captivated, my son, by an immoral woman, fondle her breast, or promiscuous woman? This is an interesting thing that he does with the language. The word captivated is a word for intoxicated. To not be able to walk straight, to stagger back and forth. So now read it again. He goes, let her breast satisfy you always. May you always be captivated by her love. May you always be intoxicated by her love. Why be captivated or intoxicated by the immoral woman? Now, this imagery gets a little more confusing. Take another step into it. The captivated, become intoxicated by her love, comes right off the idea of her breast. So in the way that a baby gets breast milk, you don't get that. But what you get from her breast is intoxicating to you. He says, be that. Have that. Be intoxicated always by her. Don't be intoxicated by another woman. It is a very interesting imagery, very graphic, to call you to the fountain that God has provided for you. All this to say, there's more work there to be done, but all of this to say is that the masculine energy is very legitimate. The relationship that would be unrestrained in this context is very, very legitimate and has heat going forward. That the boundaries of marriage do not reduce that heat like canyon walls that squeeze the river and cause it to flow. They don't reduce the walls, the boundaries don't reduce the power. They actually enhance it. They intensify it, is the idea. So let me give you some big thoughts, some things to think about. Maybe some in the context of application, some big principles to consider. The first one is this. Every man has a need for intimacy, and that need is legitimate. I think this is one of the biggest deficits that men are struggling with. They're cowering back in that, thinking that because women don't see it the same way, that the need's not legitimate, or they're overshooting it. They're overstretching it and being abusive. But the need for intimacy is legitimate. Now, let's distinguish between sex and intimacy. When you ask a man or a group of men define intimacy, they'll say sex. When you ask a group of women define intimacy, they'll say connection. In this case, the women are right. Intimacy is the bigger issue. Sex is a subcategory, a physical version of it. You have a mental version, you have an emotional version, different levels of emotion. You have a physical version called sex. You have different levels of that. So intimacy is the big idea. Sex is a subcategory underneath it. So they are not the same, though they are related. So intimacy is your great need. Sex is not your great need. Sex is a need within intimacy, but intimacy is the great need that you have to have. And you get that need through your met through your relationship with God. I think Bill talked about that, through male friends, and then in the relationship with your wife. But your soul craves intimacy. Here's what's complicated. Okay, this is a complicated issue. If you are engaged with your wife in a sexual relationship, but there is no true emotional intimacy, and so it's sex without intimacy, it will be unfulfilling. If you separate those two, it will be unfulfilling. It's a domesticated form of pornography is what it is. It's just domesticated. Instead of going out looking at other women in some other fashion where this sexual experience is separated from intimacy, you're just doing it in your home. So even in your home, sex and intimacy have to be brought together in that relationship. Those two things are always going to have to work together. The physical connection is important, but it has to happen in the context of greater emotional intimacy. In affairs, the 20 folks that I've worked with or so that have had affairs, the men, it's been fascinating for me to learn and to watch them express, think about, talk about, that does not start out as a sexual relationship, it starts out as an emotional relationship. Almost every single time. The affair does not start out sexual, it starts out emotional, and it turns into a more physical relationship. And when the guy looks at you and he goes, I promise, it's not about sex. There's a part of him that is telling the truth. He's right. There's an emotional connection that he's been starving for. Second big idea, God created marriage so man could have an environment to create a long-term sexual fulfillment and intimacy. Is that marriage is that environment. It's created for the long-term sexual fulfillment. It's a design issue. Is that intimacy flourishes in commitment. The most intense form of commitment we call marriage. So God created intimacy to happen under the umbrella of marriage. That's how that works. Is the stable, long-term. Now you go, well, I know lots of marriages that are broken that don't work. That's true. I know lots of marriages that have not been committed, so intimacy didn't flourish. That is true. But because there are deviants, because there are ones that are broken, doesn't mean that the original idea is broken. There are plenty of really good ideas that get abused or don't work or haven't worked well. But it is a design issue that intimacy flourishes in commitment. The greatest form of commitment is called marriage, so intimacy flourishes in the context of marriage. But it is challenging work, and most of us have come up a little bit short. There's a few things we didn't know or we haven't done well. Sin has creeped in, and so we wind up looking around and kind of looking for fantasy, something that is not what God has for us. The challenge to direct your sexual energy within this relationship for the long haul, that is the call that's on us. That is a great challenge for us. A couple of my friends who were on their second marriages, and when we were talking, one of them, we were traveling, he said, if I had put the kind of energy into my first marriage that I put into my second marriage, because I wouldn't have a second marriage. Now, that's not always true. Once again, what I say, I'm speaking in overgeneralities. I'm just saying, for a number of those folks, they've told me, if I had known then what I know now, put this kind of energy in originally, we would have been in a different place and I wouldn't have wound up here. And sex inside marriage over the context of a whole relationship illustrates God's relationship with his people. That we come apart, and then we come back together in intimacy, and then life takes us apart, and then we come back together in intimacy, and it just shows how God keeps taking his people back over and over. A few years ago, Mike Chabarro did a talk similar to this, and I asked him for permission. He broke life into four seasons. I want to say those seasons real quickly. It just gives you some categories to think about. You can go back and listen to the talk, pull out some more detail. The first season he threw out was the honeymoon years. He was not trying to be technical. He's just breaking life into four seasons. The honeymoon years, defined by youth and excitement, energy, frequency of our sexual relationship. This is easy. You're learning each other, exploring each other. You got a whole lifetime together. Take your time. Get to know each other, the honeymoon years. The second one I thought was interesting, the nursing baby years. Like, this is the way men think about it, that there's divided interest by the wife. She got stuff to do. She got enough people touching her, pulling on her, needing her. This can be frustrating for the man. This is where he has to step up and learn how to communicate some of his needs and struggles with his wife, and they gotta get connected. He can't just get frustrated, jealous, and pull apart. The third group is the middle trimester, which I think is funny. He names it after the middle trimester of a pregnancy, which is when you have some of the best sex in a marital relationship. So the middle trimester, he goes, these middle years, your kids are getting older, you have a little more margin, you get to kind of create some memories and experiences together. It's a great time to enjoy your relationship. There's a little more freedom, a little more romance. And then the golden years. You got to get through menopause, which is a real difficult one. Now that's there's some work there. It's difficult. And that the golden years may not be characterized by as much physical intimacy, though there still is that. There is going to be greater emotional connection, and this is where you're really going to have to like each other. Because it's not going to be characterized by physicality all the time. There's going to be a greater emotional component. But I wanted to at least give you those kind of big ideas. I think those are worthy to think about and understand what season you're in and what kind of expectations you should have. Third big idea. My responsibility. I am the sexual leader of my household. If we're saying that we're the leader in other areas, we got to be the leader here too. Too many times men are complaining about the sexual relationship within their own marriage and are not, they've abdicated their role as leader in that context. They've abdicated their role and have forgotten that I am responsible for the intimacy in my own household. And I'll give you an example that's a little bit to the side of how men abdicate their role. I have four daughters. I live in girl world, dance, ballet. I mean, I'm just with girls all the time. And one of the things, the men that I know let their daughters dress in a very immodest way. And so sometimes we'll talk about it. And here's what you find out. Is that men let their daughters dress in an immodest way because they never talk to their wives about modesty in general and how they feel about that. So then when their daughters get to be teenagers and they start going out the house and they're wearing something that the dad knows is inappropriate, his hands are tied, he can't say anything about it. Because if he says, hey, that doesn't look good, then the daughter's like, she's naive, she doesn't know. She's like, what? What are you talking about? She's like, what? And so he can't say anything because if he explains something, then the wife goes, what? What are you talking about? He's like, well, when men see you, this is what they're going to be thinking. He's never had that conversation. So then the wife would say, was that what you think? And he's like, he's never had that conversation with her, and now it's kind of too late. He feels weird. He feels like a hypocrite. He's never had that conversation. Here's what happens. So we got these girls that go out. They're very immodest. He can't say anything because he's never talked to his wife about immodesty. Or about some of his challenges, some of his temptations in life. And so now his hands are kind of tied on that issue. And so he doesn't want to be exposed for how he thinks and how he feels. Whereas you rewind the tape, go back early in the marriage, and he has some honest conversations with his wife. And I told my wife one time, I said, hey, I don't think you can wear that. She's like, why not? I was like, well, it just feels immodest. It's a little bit too much. And she's like, really? I'm like, yeah, because she's just naive. This is 20 years ago. So then we start talking. She's like, no, wait a minute. So when other women dress that way, does that make you think that? I'm like, yes, it does. Does that hurt her? Sure. She's like, well, when other men dress a certain way, it doesn't bother me. I was like, well, we're not talking about you. You're not even in this conversation yet. We're talking about me. I mean, we can make it about you if you want, but that's not what we're talking about. You're created one way, I'm created. I mean, it was, and it just, you could see her world begin to splinter and fracture as she thought, wait a minute, we're not the same person. I thought we were one. We are one in a spiritual sense. We are not one as people. We are two different people. I have a completely different set of hormones than you do. I'm created entirely different than you are. And you go, well, I don't want to hurt her. Listen, you are not hurting. You are bringing people into reality. I got to come into reality of her world. She's got to come into reality of my world. There's work that has to be done. And so if you're going to be the sexual leader, you are going to take some hits. We got to cultivate the relationship. We got to communicate. We got to listen. We got to move towards her. And when you hear the words, that is gross, that's weird, that's different, I don't understand that. So good, well, let me be very patient and let's work through it. And let me explain to you how half of the planet thinks and feels. This half thinks and feels this way. This half thinks and feels in a very different way. But what we can't do is get mad and quit. Fourth big idea. So I'm pushing on you. Lead. So here we go. You ready? She will never completely understand my need for sex. She will never completely understand where you are, but you still have to lead. I thought 10 years ago, we're gonna close the gap. We're going to move these mountains right next to each other, and it's going to be happily ever after. We have moved things closer together. I think we've worked hard to communicate, but we are never going to close that gap. I mean, there are times when I'm talking to my wife, I'm explaining something, I'm like, you do realize this is like the 50th time we've had this conversation. She's like, huh, really? I mean, we can bring things closer together, but we cannot fully bridge the gap between these two worlds. We are created differently. For men, generally speaking, sex is a path towards intimacy. It is the road. You want to be intimate? Let's get on the road. For most women, intimacy is the culmination, or sex is the culmination of intimacy. So for men, they're thinking, we want to be close, we need to have sex. For women, they're like, we get close, then we have sex. We have two very different orientations living in the same house. Which one's right? They're both right. There's a time for both of them. They just need to be understood that they're working off of different sheets. We got to come together. We're learning how to serve each other and how we relate, how we meet each other's needs. One of the things that's difficult for us, you got to think through this one, and only you can measure your heart on this. You got to make sure that you don't get your value, your esteem, and your affirmation from your wife. Now, this is complicated because sex is very affirming. It's part of what it's about. It brings value, it brings affirmation, it brings esteem. It can do those things, but you got to make sure that you are not putting the pressure on her to provide for you something that really you can only get from God. It's easy to try to get it from her, but she cannot bear up under that weight. She will let you down. You will get hurt. You will get dismantled when you do that. And we've pretty much all done that at different times. We get vulnerable. We get rejected. It becomes real painful. Make sure that it is very affirming to be in a physical relationship, but make sure you're not getting your value and your esteem from that. Jesus has to make you free to love her, not dependent on her love to be able to make life work. See, there's a difference, being dependent on her to survive versus Jesus making you free to actually love her. So when she rejects you in some way, it's okay. It's not devastating to you. Fifth idea, core reality. Men lead with their bodies, women lead with their hearts. We just have inverse orientations. For the most part, I tell women, because they'll ask sometimes, say, if you want his heart, which is what women say they want, you're going to have to take his body. She's like, that's gross. Like, I hear you. I wouldn't want his body either. Tell men, if you want her body, you got to take her heart first. So she's got work to do on the physical side. We have work to do on the emotional side. I'm not trying to be Skinnerian or behavioral. It's just how we're created. There is a need for all the masculine energy in the relationship to feed it. And there's a need of all the feminine energy in her perspective to feed it, to create intimacy. The emotional, the masculine side, the feminine side, both of them come together to feed the relationship. In a lot of our relationships, it's purely feminine energy. We've just drained out the masculine energy, and it's just feminine. There are some relationships that are very abusive that are just masculine energy. That's not good either. We need both kinds of energy coming together. The sixth one, touch your heart before you touch your body. You got to learn to study your wife. Learn that she receives love differently than you do. The love languages came out 20 years ago. Some of that is very helpful. It's not the total deal, but some of that is very helpful, where you can see some different personality, how she receives love. And I'm really good at serving kind of behind the scenes, which is ironic because I do have a stage thing I have to do. But I am much more behind the scenes, kind of serve, helping, which is not that important to my wife. It's a cruel irony. Cruel joke on me, right? Words, ironically enough, which I don't always have in an emotional way, are very important to her, and gifts. And I'm the worst gift giver in the world. So the thing that I do the best, she doesn't connect with, and the two things I do the worst are what she needs. I was like, God, what? What did I do in a past life I'm being punished for, right? But it just calls you to have to serve and connect on a different level that's not just your flesh, where you're having to say, okay, God, I'm having to lean into you. I'm having to trust you. You've been patient with me, kind to me. Now I get to be patient and kind here. So in our context, giving gifts, creating time, connecting, kind words. And here's what she signed up for. She signed up to be known by you in a way that no one else knows her. So that whether you're providing time or gifts or kind words, they reflect the fact that you know her in a way that no one else does. You see her, you get her in a way that no one else does. And here's the big daddy within touching her heart for you and for her, is that you have to learn how to reveal yourself. I was taught early on in the Christian experience that it is that women need to talk, they have more words, men don't have as many words, and so you just need to learn how to listen. I mean, there's some sexual stereotypes and all that. Some of that may be true. Some of it may be overgeneralized. But here's what I would tell you. It may be true, like in our context. My wife has a lot more words than I do. That is true of us. Like, I'm good to listen, not talk, right? But one of the great breakthroughs in our relationship is that I learn how to talk. Is that I learn how to reveal myself. Is I learn how to say, not just I'm frustrated, but I'm sad, I'm struggling, this is painful. I'm disappointed. Like, some other emotions are in there that you got to learn how to talk about. This is what is tempting for me. I need to confess some of my sins. This is what I'm afraid of. This is what I'm thinking about. This is what I'm dreaming about. That I don't just listen to her, but I communicate what's in my soul. And then I realized at one point, she's like, what are you thinking? I was like, you know, as I'm thinking through the landscape of my mind, there's nothing there. She's like, there's something there. I was like, no, I'm telling you. It's all blank. There's nothing. And she's like, for real? I was like, yeah, as I'm looking at it right now, nothing. Right? So there's times. But usually, it's just that I'm stuck. So what I've learned how to say is, hey. And so what we do is, my wife loves a fountain drink and crushed ice. So we go get a drink. So when I tell our kids we're going to get a drink, it's not an alcoholic beverage. It's we're going to get a fountain Pepsi, and there's not that many places in town that have the right kind of ice and the right kind of mix on the Pepsi. So I paid a fortune for these drinks, right, and gas to get there. So we go get a drink. And sometimes I'll have to say to her, I was like, I need to talk, and I don't even know where to start. And she'll just start asking questions. And within about 10 minutes, it'll pull back the veil for what, where I'm blocked, where I'm struggling, what's kind of got me hung up, and we'll start talking, right? And that's part of her work. So there's a work that I do for her. There's a work that she does for me. Now, we got different personalities in the room, and your relationship with your wife, you may be the talker. She may be the quiet one. That's not about male, female, right? We're talking about personality right here. But you got to work on your chemistry, and what does it look like for you to reveal yourself to her in a meaningful way? And if you're the talker, then you got to learn the difference between just talking and actually revealing what's going on with you. Last one, become an expert on touching her body. From a number of interviews that we've done, we have found out that the average man is not a very great lover because he's quite selfish. So to be a great lover of your wife means you have to learn to be an unselfish lover of your wife, okay? And she is more complex than you are. She's different than you are. For most men, foreplay is equal to hello, right? So hello, you're good, ready, I'm here. Go, let's go. Right? For her, a little more complex, going to take some more time. An unselfish lover becomes a powerful lover. We want to take time. It's not always about sex. It's got to be about connecting. Orgasm cannot be the only goal. Connecting's got to stay the main goal. We got to be creative, but still respect her. Never bring a third party in the room in the name of creating energy. The energy is here between the two of us. If there's some dysfunction, we get some counsel. We got to deal with that, but we don't ever bring a third party in the room. So let me say this before we go to our groups. This last idea. You got to remember that for most of us, you are thinking that sex is a path towards connecting. She's seeing sex as the fruit of connecting. And you are managing that all the time. You are managing how we connect. And here's the thing that we've noticed in counseling is that when someone comes in for marriage counseling and the marriage is not doing well, when you ask the sex question, they've not had sex in a long time. Now, sex doesn't make a marriage. Now, it helps feed the intimacy of a relationship, but it does not make a marriage. But if it's not present in a marriage, it is like a thermometer. It does tell you some of what is going on. Because if there's not physical intimacy, then there's not emotional intimacy. Now, can you have physical intimacy without emotional intimacy? Sure you can. But if there's no physical intimacy, it shows you, generally speaking, that something's really broken. And here's what I would say. Us as men, you have to own that. You have to take responsibility for that and say, okay, what does it look like for us to move into a healthy place? I need to talk to someone, a friend, a pastor, get some counsel. We find a counselor, whatever, but you have to take responsibility. And that begins as we go to groups and we start talking about what's one thing I can do to start making this relationship better. Let's pray. Father, we pray that as we gather in our groups, we have some questions to work from. We pray that they would stimulate good conversation, that we would be open, that we would find that this is a safe place to talk about where we are struggling, that we would gain some ground. That every day we would think about, not how do I solve this problem completely, but how do I gain some ground on this issue? We want to gain ground every day for the next couple years and get better as leaders in our home in every area, including this one. So give us your grace and give us your wisdom. Show us how to gain ground with you. We ask it in your name. Amen.